Good morning, everybody. So it is a good morning if you're a Saints fan, and not so good if you're a Giants or an Eagles fan. Yeah, well, clap now, but we'll see who's clapping at the end. Okay. So as Sarah mentioned, I'm going to be speaking about some of the findings from the Gulf Coast Child and Family Health Study, which we have been doing for a few years now, since 2006. I'm going to start with my disclosure that I have no financial relationships to disclose. I would like to acknowledge some of my collaborators on the project, including Richard Garfield from Columbia University, Deanne Gruber and Stephanie Tortu from Louisiana State, a very large and constantly evolving team of interviewers that has included over 60 people so far over the last couple of years, and then my boss, Erwin Redlener, who is the director of both the National Center for Disaster Preparedness and the Children's Health Fund, who have funded this study over the past almost 4 years. So I'd like to begin first with a little bit of laying the groundwork of what is recovery. Since what I'd like to talk about is using housing as one measure of recovery and how critical it is to understanding recovery. So Quarantelli, who is maybe the dean of disaster research and has been doing this for about 50 years, has looked at recovery as one of four types of ways of conceptualizing. And he said you could talk about reconstruction, which is the way people usually speak about recovery, that is rebuilding physical structure. You could talk about restoring an area, which would be to reestablish either physical or social patterns. You could look at rehabilitation, which moves people and buildings and systems into a better place than they were before usually. And you could think of recovery generally as both a process and as an outcome. So when you look at the level that we were interested in, which is individual and household recovery, among the central measures that really begin to make sense when you look across the literature are the following ones, which is if you've undergone a major impact, a major event, after that period has subsided, the response is done, there's a short-term recovery phase that begins, and at some mysterious point, there's a long-term recovery phase, and at some further mysterious point, you are recovered. How would we know that you're recovered? How would we know that your household is recovered? You could look at your housing stability and say, well, you're in stable housing. That must mean you're recovered. Is that sufficient in and of itself? Probably the argument would be no. You could look at economic stability and say you're now back to a place where you can again be economically productive or have stabilized your access to economic resources. Would you say that if you had that alone, you'd be recovered? Again, probably not. You need at least the housing and the economic. But then if you think about it further, how about social roles, networks, social ties? They have to be reestablished as well. In the aftermath of a disaster, particularly one that has displaced a large population, social networks and ties have been usually completely or considerably disrupted. So how you identify yourself, if before the event you said, I'm a school teacher, that's how I think of myself, that's part of my social identity and what I do. After the event, what are you? I'm an evacuee, I'm displaced, I'm a refugee. Are you still a school teacher? Well, I'm not teaching. Are you a school teacher? Well, I don't have a classroom. Are you a school teacher? Who are you? How do you think of yourself? So until the point comes when people have reestablished the social ties, connections, and identities, again, they're not recovered. Is it sufficient? No, you need housing and economic stability and the social ties. You need access to the basic infrastructure around you to allow you to accomplish all of those things. And then lastly and most importantly, you need some sense of general welfare. You need to have good physical and mental health, or at least as good as it was before. And I would argue that none of these alone is sufficient. They're all necessary, but each one alone is not sufficient. When we look at the, now I'm going to really talk about the housing alone. So when you look at the damage, the housing damage from the major hurricanes that hit in August and September of 05, Katrina, Rita, and Wilma, you could see that the scale, the magnitude is rather large, and people already know this. This is no surprise. This is based on FEMA damage assessments, and it probably is an undercount, a considerable undercount of the actual damage. It's looking at the severe or catastrophically damaged homes. You could see a total of about 120,000 in the two states. This is only including people who registered with FEMA. So anybody who would not have registered with FEMA and suffered damage to their home would not have been included in this figure. These are obviously, and you know, people have seen these pictures before. These are the pictures of damage, of flooding. This is actually a picture taken in Waveland, Mississippi, the day before the hurricane. That's the day after the hurricane. You can see that tree is just about the only thing standing, and that's a year later, where the tree has come back and a trailer has come back, but there still is a lot to go. So in order for us to look at this, what we have done with the Gulf Coast Child and Family Health Study is randomly sampled over 1,000 households in both Louisiana and Mississippi. And we did this through a multi-stage stratified sampling approach. So we began with lists. This began 6 months after the hurricane. We began with lists from FEMA of all the aggregate housing where people had been placed. So they were placed in FEMA trailer parks, in commercial trailer parks, and in hotels. We sampled off that list. We then went to each of the sampled trailer parks and hotels, and we began sampling everybody and recruiting everybody at that site as a cluster sampling. In Mississippi, we went back 6 months after that, so that was now a year after the hurricane. We replicated the sampling protocol. This time we added severely damaged census blocks, and we got a list of 600 census blocks, enumerated them, selected 150 of those, and then went and recruited people at those randomly sampled census blocks in addition to the trailer parks. So at this point, we've done three rounds of interviewing. Baseline was 6 to 12 months after the hurricane, a second year anniversary, and then the third year anniversary of the hurricane. And in fact, just this week, we have begun the fourth round of interviewing in the Gulf Coast. The group that I'm going to be talking about is generally representative of between 60 and 100,000 people who were displaced or greatly impacted by the hurricanes. The study measures that we tend to use seem fairly conventional. We use validated measures as much as we can, looking at housing and relocation status, at health measures. You'll hear about some of the measures that we've used, access, attitudes, and then people's sense of recovery, their sense of self-efficacy, their sense of community. This is just a picture of my team back in Louisiana, and I like to show the mobile unit behind us, which kept us company on our first run through the Louisiana trailer parks. So looking at our sampling, we've got recruited at baseline, you could see 1,079, split between 555 in Louisiana, 524 in Mississippi, and then you could see how the successive rounds have gone, and I just want to draw your attention to our retention rates. At wave two, it was about 75%, and it differed slightly between Louisiana and Mississippi. Most of the people who we found were happy to do the interview again. The problem was this is a very transient, mobile population. So you could see at wave two, this is now at the second anniversary, there were as many as 251 people that we could not find despite considerable effort. At wave three, we interviewed 777, again for a retention rate of around 75%, and again, we couldn't find around that same 250 mark, but not the same 250. So we found people from the first 250 that we didn't find at the second time. We caught up with them the third time, and then people that we found at the second, we missed at the third, and I'm hoping in the fourth we'll find everybody, but I'm an optimist. So the characteristics at baseline really are quite startlingly different depending upon the sites where we were doing the sampling. So you can think that there were three major types of sites. We had a Louisiana population that was displaced into trailer parks and hotels, a Mississippi population displaced into trailer parks, and a Mississippi population that was simply displaced, that was not displaced, that was living back in their community. They had managed to get back, but they had been living in a very severely damaged community, community on the Gulf Coast. You could see that gender, not major differences, but race, enormous differences. And I would just bring your attention, draw your attention to that. In Louisiana, 75% of our respondents in the parks were African American, compared to 37% in Mississippi. In the parks versus only 2% back in the community. The age was different, the partnership status was different, the earning income was certainly different, and even the households with kids were different. this, I really want to get down to the housing progression here. So this shows from our wave three, that is the 777 people that we spoke to and found in wave three, this is picking them and looking at what happened to those 777 households. And what you would see that at the first year, 14% ended up in stable housing. That meant that 668 were unstably housed. At 2 years post-Katrina, another 17% found stable housing, but 555 were still unstably housed, meaning they were either living in a FEMA trailer or they were living in a place that they could not stay in for more than a year, or that they were unsure that they could stay there, or they were doubled up with friends and family. And then at the third year post-Katrina, you could see that another 144 made it into stable housing, but 411 remain unstably housed. So what we've done to begin analyzing this is to use what's called the Kaplan-Meier survival estimate. So as a survival analysis, those people who have done these are maybe accustomed to looking at them as a result of a therapeutic treatment, does a group of patients survive? So you want to see, and how long have they survived over time? What this does is it gives you a cumulative conditional probability of survival. At this point, the key element of survival that I'm looking at is really leaving unstable housing and moving into stable housing. To me, that is the outcome of interest. So for the whole group, what you could see is that the median days to stable housing, and this doesn't allow, it's right censored, meaning it doesn't allow for the right hand to really keep moving the way it should. So it sort of assumes that everybody at that last day has now achieved stable housing. So it's an underestimate, is 915 days. So we began to look at how this differs by a couple of different characteristics. So by income, I'm not sure how well you could see this, but if you look at the red and the blue on the top, that suggests that those folks are taking much, much longer to get into stable housing. So when they hit that red line, which is the median, they're somewhere around the 1,000-day mark. Whereas those households with income greater than $50,000 a year, they've hit that median stable housing mark somewhere around 620 days. So there's a difference of over a year. And what you could see is both the slope itself of people with greater income is steeper, meaning they're getting into stable housing faster. The fact that there's such a gentle slope above with the folks who earn less than $20,000 means they're staying in unstable housing for a much longer period of time before they begin to arrive at the stable housing. When we look at differences between black and white respondents, no difference, same curve. When we look at differences by age, we again see a difference, which is that the older you are, the more likely you are to achieve stable housing. And this does make sense. It's going to be associated with income and a number of other characteristics. And the youngest population here, again, is at that top line there, that top gentle curve, taking the longest to achieve stable housing. This is a measure of mental health. It's based on something called the Mental Component Summary Score, which is measured. It's a 12-item measure from SF-12. And what it looks at is whether or not you are mentally distressed or disabled, essentially. So we've dichotomized this to say you're above or below a cut point, you're distressed or not distressed for simplicity's sake, and what you would see is those that are distressed far, far more likely to be in unstable housing and have a longer period of time before they arrive at stable housing. When we look at whether there are kids in the home and whether it makes a difference, it doesn't make a difference. We thought it might, it did not. So we took all of this because those Kaplan-Meier statistics are really descriptive. They don't tell you in the way a regression analysis would, controlling for the other factors, what are those factors associated with time to stable housing. So here are the factors taken in a Cox regression analysis. These are hazard ratios that are very much like an odds ratio. And these are looking at what are the factors associated with time to stable housing. People who have a good positive sense of community are 1.09 times as likely to be in stable housing as people who have a poor sense of community. People living in a private trailer versus a group home, 5 times as likely to end up in stable housing. People living in a house versus a group, this is almost tautological though, are 7.5 times as likely to end up in stable housing. And the income, obviously, if you earn over 20, you're 1.6 times. If you have good mental health, 1.7. If you're older, slight advantage. If you're black, according to this regression now, it does show a difference. It shows you you're two-thirds as likely. So even though the descriptive statistic was showing it doesn't look like there's any difference, when you control for some of the these other factors, particularly where you're living and the income differences and probably the mental health, all of a sudden now it's showing that people who are African-American are two-thirds as likely to be in stable housing. And surprisingly to me, at least, when I looked at this initially, and I'm still trying to understand why this would be, people in Louisiana are 1.5 times as likely to be in stable housing. The reason I say surprisingly is that I'm familiar enough with a lot of the housing projects and programs there, the state-level programs, that I would have hypothesized that Mississippi folks had moved into stable housing faster. The Louisiana Road Home Program run through the Recovery Authority has been, it has a huge task, and it I think it has closed on 120,000 loans or projects with the homes, but still it has a fairly large backlog, and it had a fairly large demand. On the other hand, on Mississippi side, they had the Katrina Cottage Program, which was up and running way before Louisiana even got off the ground on it. It was a very successful program, so I was really surprised to see, and I think this sort of requires more attention on our part to understand exactly how that happened. When I look at when I take what we know so far and I project out how long will it be before the population that we're looking at is housed, it's going to be about 6 years at best for about 95% of this group to be stably housed. Now, I want to put that in context for you. In Kobe, Japan, after the 1995 earthquake, which destroyed 200,000 houses, so it's the same magnitude, if not larger, than the one we're talking about here, and killed, if I'm not mistaken, over 2,000 people. Clearly the same magnitude. They housed everybody. They closed the last person requiring stable housing 4 years after the hurricane. So today, it should be today, if we were following the same model, that everybody in the Gulf Coast would be back in stable housing. Would they be recovered? Well, if you go back to my initial slide looking at the economic recovery, the social ties, and the general welfare, I would say maybe not, but they'd be a lot better off than if they didn't have the stable housing. In Sichuan, China, after the 2008 earthquake, this still remains to be seen what happens, but the Chinese government made a very firm commitment that they said in 3 years, everybody will be housed. Similar level of damage, 200,000 homes destroyed. So in both those cases, I would argue, there was a national mandate and will and a considerable amount of political will to say we've got a deadline, we've got performance measures that say we are going to house people in a certain amount of time. It's a critical element towards their recovery, and we think that it's worth doing. When you look at what the consequences are of unstable housing, here are some of the consequences. So amongst our group, of those people who are unstably housed, over 2.3 times as likely those who are unstably housed to report some type of mental health disability. Now, you don't know which direction this is going. You don't know whether this is a reciprocal relationship. Are those people who are mentally disabled or distressed having a harder time to find housing, or is it because they don't have housing that they're mentally distressed? Hard to say, but clearly if you solve one, it's a good idea. Almost twice as many are likely to report a child with emotional problems, three times as likely to report a poor sense of community, almost twice as likely to have a child whose academic performance was worse after the hurricane, almost twice as likely to have not have adequate social support. And these were all controlled for income, so regardless of whether or not somebody had income above or below $20,000. So that's a fairly striking demonstration of the importance of stable housing. And with this, I just want to sort of return to that notion of when we look at stable housing as a recovery measure, this is really designed to be, you know, part one of a multi-part effort to measure recovery, because how do we know that a population has recovered? My argument would be that you would know that when the population has stable housing, stable economic resources, social ties, roles, and adaptation, and a general sense of welfare, of good physical and mental health, where they have access to a civic infrastructure around them that is stable. Thank you.